Lord Jellicoe, Reel 3.
This was about 3 weeks, I think, before the German next offensive, which after a very, very, as you know, a lot of toing and froing and heroic French defense and action at Bir Hakeim, led in fact to the pretty disorderly retreat of the 8th Army right up to back to El Alamein and the fall of Tobruk.
So you say the wound went bad, you mean you got gangrene?
My wound went bad, yes, or it got very infected. I was evacuated to the casualty clearance station in Tobruk, and they took a look at it, and they said, you better go back to Alexandria. So I was shipped back to Alexandria, into the 64th General Hospital, which I remember with great affection. I used to read a great deal and rather sort of stuck up and snobbish about reading. And I remember reading a great deal of Proust when I was 10 days or a fortnight in hospital with this wound being looked after. And I think, of course, one's, I don't know, it just suited me then. I've never been read Proust with any real autant de, what's it, tiens, autant de, oh, I can't remember the name of the great Proust novel. Memory of Time Past. Temps Perdu, yes. And we were marvelously well looked after there, as I've always been in any military hospital except one, I'll just mention to you. It couldn't have been better looked after there. We had a really beautiful nurse, amongst others. She was only 24. She had snow-white hair, and her name was Miss Dollar Bugle, and we used to call her Penny Whistle. And she very nearly became the Duchess of Wellington. She missed it by a whisker, but she did marry extremely well. And she looked after us, couldn't have looked after us more kindly. And I'm not making any aspersions on her character in saying that. We were marvelously well looked after. I was released after 10 days or so, went on leave to Cairo, and then I ran into David Sterling. And he said, what about joining me? I was still on sick leave, and I said, yeah, I like the idea very much indeed. Can you fix it up with my battalion? He said, yes, I can fix it up with your battalion. I then went off on a week sick leave, I think. It was meant to be up to Beirut. And there I got malaria, and spent 2 days, I think, in staying with Bill Astor, who was doing something in up the hill, a lovely house. And I think he thought 2 days was enough looking after this young officer, so I was then sent to a hospital, a casualty clearing station, an Australian casualty clearing station, which was manned by Australian male nurses, no Miss Dollar Bugles. And I don't think I've ever got out of a hospital quicker than I got out of the... I didn't fancy being looked after nurse by Australian male nurses, much though I appreciate and like the Australians. And I went back to Cairo and then joined... it was then still called L Detachment of the SAS, as technically as David Sterling's second-in-command. And I'm trying to think this. By now, we must be May or late April, about May, later. You know the Bir Hakeim dates and things better than I do. It must have been about May 42.
Yes, probably a bit later.
It can't have been a great deal later. It may have been later May, yes.
Where had you met David Sterling in Cairo?
Oh, I suppose I ran into him at Shepherd's Hotel, where everybody met everybody. But I just ran into him by sheer chance, I think. I don't think I had an appointment or anything.
So was he on some recruiting expedition, or did
no,
he
I
just
think,
come straight off the top of his head?
No, I think he was in. I think he was in between raids by then. I'm sure he was, or planning raids, staying with his brother Peter, that lovely flat they had. I may have met him by design, because I knew very well that he and Jock Lewis, both of whom I'd known pretty well in Number 8 Commando, had, I knew that he'd set up this raiding force. And of course I may have been attracted by it. I can't recall. I think it was sheer chance, but it may not have been. And he may have been in touch with me when he found out that I was in hospital or something like that. I don't know. I'd always liked him. I'd heard a bit about what they'd been doing, and was intrigued, I think.
Was he still the Great Sloth?
No. He was a very different. He was a very different animal then. And he'd already, of course, had after that disastrous first raid of his, in which was part of the November offensive, time to that 41 offensive, he'd already achieved some really spectacular successes, mainly blowing up German airplanes together with Jock Lewis. Jock was killed on only the second operation, and it was a very, very great loss to the SAS. And David quite rightly has always said that without Jock Lewis, the thing could never really have got off the ground. He was a marvelous training officer. Like David, had a good eye for choosing the right people. But he invented the Lewis bomb, which is the thing we used for destroying aircraft. But, I mean, they made a very powerful trio, as the three main players. David Sterling, who I think had quite unusual qualities for that moment. I mean, extraordinary imagination, very quick grasp that the sort of quick grasp that open desert flank was a heaven-sent opportunity for the right sort of special force activity that the rather clumsy commando tactics, attacking an aerodrome by sea from an old gunboat with 90 or 100 men or 150, whatever we were, was not the right way to go about it. It was to use the open flank of the desert and do it by small groups of people, highly trained people. His quick grasp of that, then his extraordinary persuasiveness, his ability to get through to the top and get his own way, the way he forced himself upon General Auchinleck and upon de Gingon, his chief of staff. And then, goes without saying, a very high degree of courage, but also extraordinary powers of leadership.
So why were his powers of leadership so extraordinary? Because he led from the front?
Of course he led from the front. But he had a sort of, I suppose it's partly a chemical thing, but you knew that he would do anything which, and much more than he was asking of oneself. And success breeds success. He'd brought off these operations, and he was already invested with a sort of magnetism. I fell very much under the spell of this. And I'll never forget David as, in many ways, one of the most remarkable people I've ever met in all my life. But I also associate Jock Lewis with what I'm saying, because I do know that how right David was to have the tremendous regard he had for Jock. It was a great loss to the SAS that he was killed on his second operation. I've had the good fortune to run into Sher Chance in Tirana late at night, 6 months or so ago, a retired gentleman who was taking aid out to the Albanians. And as we were chatting in one of the only two hotels in Tirana, I discovered that his sister had been engaged to Jock Lewis. And I therefore had the privilege of seeing the exchange of letters between them. She died, she married an American doctor, and she died 6 months or so ago, a year ago. And there's a marvelous exchange of correspondence between her and her young fiancé, Jock Lewis. And that reading, that exchange, one realizes he was a very highly principled person, very clever person indeed. And I can understand even more why David had that high opinion of him. And then there was the third member of the trio, Paddy Mayne, of course, who was an extraordinary sort of tactical genius, brave as 10 lions. I've just written what I felt about him in the Oxford book of whatever it is, National Biography, and just been reissued. So I won't repeat all that, what I feel about him. But they were a tremendous trio, and then Bill Fraser and people, and marvelous Bill Kumper, the running the engineering side of it. They were a very powerful team, and he had picked absolutely the right people. And Fitzroy McLean had joined him by then.
What did Stirling require you to do when he recruited you?
Well, I never quite knew what David wanted me to do. I think he said he wanted me as his second in command. I think he wanted me to try to get a little bit more organization and administration into the outfit, which it rather lacked, to say the least. He certainly was very keen when things like jeeps became available and we got the first jeeps in the desert, that we should lay our hands on them, that we should... he wanted to see that the Vicar K's were properly mounted in our jeeps and things like that. I think he looked upon me to making some liaison with the more effective liaison with GHQ, that type of thing. and I think he also was rather keen because he knew that I spoke French. He just got a marvelous detachment of free Frenchmen to join him from Syria under Georges Berger and his second in command, Jourdan. And I think he, knowing that I spoke French, he thought that I was the obvious person to do the liaison with them and bring them into the SAS, which wasn't easy to do. It wasn't difficult to do because they were a very remarkable lot of young men under a marvelous commander in his own right, Georges Berger. And I think if ever Georges is getting on now, I see a lot of him. And if ever, it would be very worthwhile, I think somebody, one day talking to Georges Berger whilst he's still alive, he's married to a charming English lady, lives near Bayonne, Mimizan Plage. I think that's probably, was roughly what David had in mind for me. but very soon... of course, one found oneself doing operations, which was much more interesting than mucking about at Cabrit or going to GHQ Cairo or trying to see that the right jeeps were turning up in the right quantities, the right Vicar K's, all that.
What operations did you first do with Stirling?
Well, the first operation I did with them was an attack on airfield in Crete. This was in June 41, and it was part of a whole series of attacks on German airfields along the, there were four planned for Crete, on German airfields in Crete. And there were, I think, about, I'm speaking from memory, about five other attacks in which the French part of the SAS, the French element, were also prominently on desert aerodromes. And these were timed to coincide with the passage of two convoys to Malta. And Malta was extremely hard-pressed at the time. It was vital these two convoys get through in whole or in part, one from the west from Gibraltar, the other from the east from Alexandria. And it was timed, it was the aim to reduce the bomber offensive on these two convoys. And what David asked me to do was to go with Georges Berger and three of his men. They were fine men, a marvelous man called Mouault, a very nice young man called Lerstic, who pretended to be 18 or so, but was in fact only just 16 or barely 17. And a Jack called, a person whom I see quite a lot of now, called Jacques Sibard. We were to do one of the, and with a Cretan officer in the Greek army as our guide and interpreter, we were charged with attacking one of the aerodromes in Crete at Heraklion. And I think David asked me to do that because he thought that, well, the French were going to need help with the Navy, as I spoke, as I had sort of rather easy access to the Navy, and as I spoke French, I was the obvious person to accompany Georges Berger on that thing. The So, do you want me just briefly to say about that operation? It's a very simple operation. We were due to, we were due to sail from in a Greek submarine, the Triton, bought from the French, I suppose, in the early 20s, that and the Papanicolaus. She was then getting a bit long in the tooth, and she was quite small. She was about 15 year old. I don't think I'd recommend, if anybody wanting comfortable Aegean travel, taking passage in a small Greek, French-built old submarine. But we did our training for this very quickly in Alexandria. I remember we used to know the young ladies of Alexandria, and they were very nice indeed. And they, two of them, whom I knew quite well, had been swimming with. They saw us on this. They saw us training, and I think they must have put two and two together. In any case, we took passage in the Triton, which was very well commanded by absolutely first-rate Greek naval officer, and to Crete. We were towed in. I remember my first sight of Greece was through the periscope of this Greek submarine. We saw the northeast coast of Crete. We came in we were due to land a bit closer to Heraklion than we in fact did, because there was a westerly wind blowing. And we were put ashore. Submarine surfaced. We had our two or three rubber boats, which we paddled in. We thought we were only going to be about a mile offshore, but in fact we were about 3 miles, so we had a very long paddle in indeed. We then landed. There was nobody on the beach. The beach was clear. Moore and I, there were two rubber boats. We undressed and we swam out with these two rubber boats loaded with shingle and rocks, and then deflated them so they sank, so there was no trace of that. And then we had planned to get into position by that March that night where we could see the airfield and observe it, but we'd miscalculated. We'd landed further, much further to the east than had been, because of the breeze, than it had been planned. It was extraordinarily rough going. We had far too much heavyweight equipment. A great mistake, but there it was. So we disembarrassed ourselves of some of that equipment, and we hadn't got all that far that we couldn't observe the aerodrome that day. So we lay up that day, and then we got into position that evening, by which we thought we could get onto the aerodrome, but not having observed it properly, we went in where we tried to get through. We ran into a German patrol. We were fired upon, so all surprise had gone. So we thought the only thing to do was to withdraw, to get to a place where we could have it under proper observation, which we did the next day. So we were able to come onto it at a place which we thought was we would get through. And that was all fine. And we were cutting the airfield defenses were pretty well wired. And I suppose the depth of the wire was at least the length of this room. And unfortunately, as we were just getting through, getting on to the a German patrol came down. I thought they hadn't seen us, but the last man had. So we were immediately challenged. And I couldn't think for the life of me what to do. In the sort of split second, one had to do something. One could have thrown a grenade or something. That had been the end of the German patrol, but it had been the end of any surprise. Or we could have tamely surrendered. I didn't really know. But a sergeant, I think he was, Moore, he may have been Corporal Moore, he had a sudden inspiration, and suddenly inspired, he lay on his back and started to snore. And the German patrol moved on, and we later knew from a captured document that they had mistaken us for drunken Cretan peasants. And then two Blenheims came over to bomb the aerodrome. Of course, it had been said they would bomb it if we hadn't got onto it the first night. And that's also helped us, because in the resulting confusion, I think the patrol had second thoughts about coming up again. We cut ourselves through, and we then placed our charges. I think we destroyed one little plane, a Fiesler Stork, and about 23 Ju-88s. And then we had the pleasure of marching out in what we thought was good German formation, out through the main gate. And also the pleasure as we lay up, having scurried back as far as we could, of hearing these explosions going off. What was less pleasant was in the morning when we are lying up, not having navigated very well, and it's extremely complicated, the geography around there. It's all around Knossos and places like that. We had something which was less pleasant. As always, we were quickly discovered by Cretans or Greeks, and they told us the news that a rather high number, I think it was 80 German hostages, had been shot as a reprisal for this, including the former Greek Governor General of Crete. And that was pretty depressing. Whether the Germans thought this had been carried out, they must have known this had not been done by Cretans. But later on, one learns by this, Paddy Lee Firmer, when he captured the German General Kreiper in Crete, he was at pains to leave messages to say this had been carried out by British forces, etc., etc. rather difficult to do at preserving security, because he left it in the general's car. Any case, we then had a rather long walk back across the island. I suppose it took us, we only moved at night, 3 nights. And that went uneventful. That went fine.
Were you receiving help from the Cretans?
No, we were rather keeping ourselves to ourselves on the whole, but they always discovered us. They are the most marvelous. Well, I now know a great deal more about Crete than I did then. And we crossed the Masara Plain, which was the only really difficult bit, because it's very open there, east of Timbaki. And we were lying up after, I suppose, 3 or 4 days, or 3 or 4 nights. And as usual, somebody found us in a little valley, a Cretan, and he was very nice. And Georges Berger was suspicious of him, but our guide, Petrakis, I remembered his name, he said he knew him, he came from the village, perfectly all right, fine. So very shortly after that, it must have been about, and he came back with some food and some wine, which was very welcome. We were a bit thirsty and we were a bit famished by then. And very shortly after that, Georges Berger said, would I go off with Petrakis to make rendezvous with the agent from the place where we were going to re-embark. And I said, yes. So I went off in the evening with Petrakis, I suppose 5 or 6 miles over the hills, or quite a mountainous little coastal range there, made the contact. Petrakis's feet had given up by then, or his boots and feet had. So I went back alone at night, went down to the valley where I thought I'd left my French friends and couldn't find them. I was very puzzled, so I went up the head of valley. There are a lot of parallel valleys in that along the bordering the plain. And I tried 3 to the left and couldn't find them, then 3 to the right, couldn't find them. Then at first light, I came back to the original one and went down it and immediately saw it was the right one. And I came to the place where I'd left my French friends, and I was immediately suspicious, because there were some of their remains were bits of belongings were there, and they were all tidy. And I said to myself, "Tiens, this is not my, this is not how my French friends behave. There's something wrong." And at the moment, 3 or 4 boys came running up the valley. I don't quite know what they said. It sounded like fouillety, fouillety, bum bum, and things. And they were making it very clear that something had gone very wrong. And what had gone in, so I cleared out. And what had gone so wrong, it was a very unfortunate thing. There were very, very few Quislings in Crete. We, by sheer misfortune, had hit upon one. This chap who'd brought us the wine and thing, he then sent his little boy running into Timbaki to say there were British or troops there.